I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box. In this programme, we dig deep into the far corners of arts and culture across Birmingham and beyond to seek out the eclectic, the challenging, and the inspiring. Coming up in the box this time round, we consider what Big Brother did next through Prototype Theatre's illumination of our digital destiny by way of their performance piece, a machine they're secretly building. And we add colour and perspective to works of fine and visual art as we talk to artists exhibiting in the annual showcase that is New Arts West Midlands 2017. If you'd like to seek out more information and links to items featured in the show, check out our blog, thenewcuriositiesbox.blogspot.co.uk. New Art West Midlands showcases the work of five university art schools in the region: Birmingham City, Coventry, Staffordshire, Wolverhampton and Worcester, as well as Hereford College of Arts. Across four venues, the exhibition draws in 31 artists with varied media, approaches and messages. To get a better sense of it all, I started by talking with curator Jessica Litherland. So I'm here at the private viewing, the kind of pre-opening night of the new West Midlands Art 2017 exhibition.
New Art West Midlands.
I nearly got it right, didn't I? And I'm here with Jessica Litherland.
Yes.
And your role is a kind of curator?
That's right. I'm a visual arts producer here at MAC, but I'm responsible for curating all the exhibitions here, and it's been my responsibility to select artists from the overall applications. There were 31 that were selected by the first level of selectors, and those 31 artists come to us curators from the different venues, and then we pick the artists we want to show in our venues. So I've picked 13 artists here. I've actually got a nice spread from all the different universities. That was incidental, but it's worked out quite nicely.
So that's quite a tough job, isn't it, getting the spread, and I guess you see a lot of art. And
I do.
So how do you go about making that selection? It's not an easy thing.
It's not, but I mean, that's the fun part of my job, working with a lot of artists and seeing a lot of work. And what I'm looking for MAC was something that works with the context that we're here. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting to see a lot of the artists were looking at work that looked at the environment, and because MAC's sited here in Cannon Hill Park, it made a lot of sense to look at those works. So the first few works that you see in the exhibition are all looking at the environment in different ways.
Okay, so when we're talking art, for listeners, what do we mean by art? Because it means a lot of things to different people. Are we talking paintings and sculptures, or a bit more than that?
A little bit more than that. There are paintings here. There's some beautiful paintings. There's some beautiful print work. There's some sculpture. But we've also got some films, some projections, and some installation work. So there's a little bit of a mixture of everything. Something for the traditionalists and something for the contemporary art lovers among you.
So something kind of to comfort and to intrigue, is that the idea?
Absolutely.
Excellent. And how long is the exhibition on for? Is it end of May?
Yeah, 14th of May.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Now this is the kind of second or third incarnation, or has it been running longer than that?
I think this is the fifth time it's run, so it's been running for quite a long time, and it's just an amazing opportunity for all these emerging artists to be able to work with a professional gallery and professional curators, possibly for the first time, to present their work, and that should give them a really good basis for developing their work in the future and their careers as well.
So I guess there's a few nerves among some of the the people there on show tonight.
Absolutely, but they've got nothing to be nervous about. They've all worked really hard and the exhibition looks really good. I'm really pleased with how it's come together.
And presumably for some of the kind of installations, some of the pieces, is it the first time they've kind of been aired in public, or...?
All this work was shown at their degree shows, but it will be the first time it's been in a public space for the majority of the work.
So there's a bit of pressure there?
A little bit of pressure, yeah, but they've all been very good and they've handled it very well.
Excellent. So I'm going to stroll around and talk to some of the other artists.
Lovely.
And when I've picked out some that I either can't understand or that I really like,
okay,
I'll get your view.
Come back to me.
Excellent.
Okay, I'll see you soon.
Thanks, Jess.
Thank you.
New Art West Midlands 2017 exhibits across the Waterhall Gallery at Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery, MAC Birmingham, Wolverhampton Art Gallery and Worcester City Art Gallery. But what of the artists themselves? Well, I managed to speak to some of them as well. Okay, so I'm with Lorna Brown, one of the artists involved in the exhibition, from Hereford College of Arts. Lorna, you're clutching a glass of red wine, which many an artist, I think, needs on this kind
several.
Of occasion. So tell me about your work and how you've come to be exhibiting.
So this particular piece of work is discussing Western beauty ideals. Um, I think, you know, beauty ideals are very powerful and we begin sort of engaging with the politics of beauty quite early. But particularly for me, as a mixed race person growing up in a very sort of rural West Country area, I was made very aware of the fact that I didn't necessarily meet these ideals. So in this piece of work, I've taken things that people have said to me, that's teachers, friends, acquaintances in the past, and I've taken those words and made pictures that illustrate the power of those words. And I came to be in this exhibition just from my tutor, who mentioned the New Art West Midlands to me and told me at the last minute that I should apply. So I applied on the final day.
No time like the present, they say, don't they?
Yeah.
So the sort of subject, the kind of topic of your work, if you like, the focus of your work.
Yes.
Is it right to say it's controversial? Maybe not for its own point, but you know, for its own sake. Is it designed to provoke, or is it exploration?
Exploration, but certainly designed to provoke, you know, thought and conversation about a topic that isn't very often discussed, or perhaps not very often thought about.
And what's the kind of medium you use most? Is it paint? Is it sort of graphic? Or
it's all photography, all mixed media photography. So each photo is a self-portrait, and I've then pierced into each image, or painted onto it, or embroidered into it. And it's sort of, in a way, talking about the destructive nature of those efforts to change your appearance, really. And I wanted something tangible that would express that. So
there's a kind of environmental theme that I'm picking up already from the exhibition. And is yours about how sort of people interact with the environment or change by their environment?
Certainly not about how people interact with their environment, but you could say how people change with their environment. I mean, it's really discussing identity and the sort of instability of that, I suppose.
We are at an interesting time, I think, aren't we, in our society, let's say, where
Definitely. Identity
is a kind of daily consideration. You kind of you can't sort of just get on with your cornflakes anymore. You've got to think about your identity every morning.
You have, and I do find it really interesting at, you know, a time when London is now, it could be said, one of the most multicultural cities in the world, but yet the divide in a sense is growing, or there's more sort of unrest in the sense that people are more drawn to right-wing patriotism.
What things are you working on now? Obviously you've done a number of things for the exhibition.
Are you
progressing other projects? And
I've got two projects that I'm working on at the moment. I'm not sure that I want to talk about them
okay.
too much at the moment.
Top secret.
Well,
they're still formative.
Yes.
Okay. Well, it's great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for that, and enjoy the exhibition.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Yasmin Boyle, Birmingham City University, one of the artists exhibiting here, and you're a sculptor even.
I am.
You're not a sculpture, that would be silly, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So Yasmin, just to describe the piece in the programme, in the exhibition, it kind of has a kind of conical feel. There's elements of lampshade I'm picking up, but I'm probably again not doing it much justice. Is this something about restraint?
So it's kind of a merge between the female form and cosmology. So I kind of challenge the stereotypical gender stereotyping that we have and kind of look at it from a very masculine aesthetic, and then try and find a meeting in the middle to merge them sort of gender types together. So you've got this steel frame, you've got like this explosion of energy, and then you've got the curves around the centre of it. But each of these bars are etched with a pearlescent lace print. So you've got that element of the femininity within it. And then this very engineered mathematical form has been slumped. So gravity is making this form very slump now, very human. So it's that merging of the two. You've got artists that were inspirational at this point, was Barbara Hepworth. You've got people that very masculine aesthetic sculpture like Richard Serra. Very huge metal sculptures.
Now, I definitely didn't do it justice in my description. And I imagine that when you approach the kind of creative process, how do you start? Do you start with sketches? Do you start with photos, images? Or do you just go straight?
A lot of reading.
A lot of reading, okay.
A lot of reading. I find that artistic theory will always help you kind of funnel down your ideas, and then it will be sketching and then seeing whether you can actually make those sketches into process. Because obviously there's So a lot of experimentation beforehand.
Yeah, so I imagine there's a lot of kind of early versions, draft versions.
Yeah, these are 3 meters in length and about two in height. And these started off at about 1.5. So there was a lot of smaller modular forms that I was playing around with. And then the etching came later on. And the etching was quite a hard process because it's steel.
Right.
So chemical etching doesn't work so much with steel. You need like a copper.
Is that hard work?
Yeah, it is. So in the end, because you're physically having to push and pull.
Yeah.
So you're fighting with the metal. So that's quite an interesting notion when you're thinking about the topics in which I'm trying to challenge as a woman.
And is it a fairly lonely process in terms of, you know, because you're focusing on your work and you're focusing on, you know, trying to express yourself through your work. Are there other artists that you sort of work with or, you know, kind of have a peer group that you can sort of talk to about ideas?
University was very much a very social place anyway, and you're always sharing ideas. I think that's definitely, when you're among our fellow artists that are talking about lots of different topics, everything influences you.
Yeah.
Your teachers, your peers, life in general will influence you.
From the picture in front of us, we can't quite get an idea of scale.
Yes.
But for folks who want to go and see it, just remind us where it's...
It's based at the Waterhall Gallery, which is part of BBAG, and that's just over the road from the School of Art in Birmingham.
Excellent. Well, I will let you now charge your glass.
Thank you.
And thank you for your time. Thank you for talking to me.
Thanks.
Okay, so I'm with Sarah Zaharik, who is going to explain to me some rather striking black and white centrepieces of the exhibition. Sarah, I'm not going to attempt to describe them, but I'm drawn immediately to a man with an accordion.
Okay.
So tell us a little bit about that context of the work.
The project started when I found some old photographic negatives of my father's. He took them in the late 1980s when he went to Poland with his father, who's from Poland. So these images were taken in my grandfather's hometown. My father died a couple of years after he took these photographs. I was still quite small, so I don't have any memories with my father. So the project sort of became about me trying to create some new memories with him. I became quite obsessed with scanning the negatives. And
kind of
tracing.
Labour of love, I guess.
It really was, yeah. It was like a deeply personal project, but I would spend hours on Google Street View trying to find some of like the street scenes. Just walking around trying to find where the images might
I
be
taken.
I
thought it was only detectives that did that kind of thing.
I am like an honorary detective. but I found like my first place on Google Street View, and the excitement that I got from doing that was so huge that I thought, if I actually stand in that place, then how amazing is that going to feel? So that's what really drove me to go to Poland, and it became about recreating these images side by side so that I could sort of know that I was stood where my father had been stood. So I essentially went to Poland to photograph the floor, which is these pieces here. And as part of the exhibition, I encouraged people to stand on the floor that I stood on, that my father stood on, so they can see the views that we both saw. So these comparison images are more, they're like evidence that I was as close to the exact spot that my father was as possible.
So just to describe that to listeners, on the floor here in the exhibition, there are kind of, are they vinyl prints kind of pavements, essentially, stone paving from where you stood. And then this kind of postcard, I go picture postcard, I know they're pictures, but of where you were, where you visited, a kind of before and after, really.
Yeah.
It's a bit like time travel in some ways. Is that what you're up to?
Yeah, I'm a time traveller. I try to obviously compose them as precisely as possible. I shot them on colour film because that's what my father shot on. And I've printed both his and mine images in the colour dark room. So again, it's like deeply personal. But the idea is that people can stand on these rather mundane images of the floor, essentially. But by putting them into a gallery space, I'm saying that they're significant and that these spots are really important to me.
There's something that strikes me as well about old and new in terms of what you're doing. So you've said that you found old photos that kind of led you to different places, but you found them in quite a new way.
Yeah.
So what I mean by that, in the 80s, Google Earth and Google Maps wasn't there, was it?
No.
Didn't exist.
Absolutely.
But then you've kind of captured finding the place through photography. a very old medium. Is that intentional?
It sort of became intentional as the project progressed. So, for example, on these posters that you're talking about at the beginning, I've got this QR code. If people scan that with their mobile phone, they can find a link to my website. It tells more information about the project. The video that we've got over there is also on the website, and more of these images. The images within the posters are from my father's original negatives. They're all presumably family members that I don't know who they are or where they are. So when I went to Poland, I actually made very small scale versions of these, and I put them on the walls around the city in the hope that people might, you know, contact me.
And there's another interesting thing there, I think, about memory, because, you know, a lot of us take snaps on our phones pretty much every day, and we know the time and the place and everything, because it's coded, you know, it's there somewhere in the image. But in the past, that's not the case. You know, you take a picture and that's it. So I've got boxes at home that I've no idea who the people are, you know, so there's something there about, I suppose, about the kind of collective memory, isn't there?
Yeah, and that's sort of something that I'm trying to recreate. Well, the aim was that I would go there and find people that could collectively help me piece together information about my father. I'm guessing it's late 1980s by what people have told me. So family vaguely remember him going to Poland when I was very young. He died when I was 4, so I'm presuming it was like very late 1980s that he went. But everything else is sort of like, it's like clues.
And that, whether kind of unintentionally or not, that's a very significant period in Polish
history,
isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah, you know? Absolutely. So again, I'm thinking probably 1989 was around the time that they went. It's quite insightful to look at the original photographs as well. Like, it was initially about the street scenes for me, but I really wanted to find a way to use these original family photographs within the exhibition, because you get to see a little insight into late 1980s Poland. So in this image over here, you can see what they were eating, what they were drinking, the brand of cigarettes they were smoking. In some of the family images, they've got huge jars of mayonnaise and like pickled things on the table. And as well, these photographs here of the children having their portrait taken, hands like dead against their sides, as if they've perhaps not had too many photographs taken of themselves.
Now, my knowledge of Polish is pretty rubbish, I have
Mine
to say.
Is as
I don't
well.
Speak Polish at all, but the language, the text that you have, it's kind of, I think to best describe it, it looks like a kind of lost and found poster, you know, kind of, it's kind of like a lost cat poster.
Yeah, that's
now,
exactly
I'm presuming
what it is.
The text doesn't say, can you help me find my cat?
No, across the top it says, is this you? I don't speak Polish either, so again, that is me sort of trying to find part of my heritage. I feel like perhaps I should speak Polish because my surname is Zaharik, but I lost that element of me, I think, when I lost my father. So I used Google Translate for these posters when I went over. Since then, I've had people translate my artist statements for me for upcoming exhibitions, translate it properly into Polish. But I wanted to keep these quite authentic, because when I went out there, they probably didn't make a lot of sense in Poland.
More from the exhibition in the final section of the show, and even more at newartwestmidlands.co.uk. I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box. In the information age, are there dark forces amassing against us? Have we slipped past a line of control in our online lifestyles? Well, I spoke to Rachel Bainton and Gillian Lees about these themes as they see them, through their performance theatre piece, A Machine They're Secretly Building, which played recently at Mac Birmingham.
I'm with Rachel and Gillian in a very echoey, sterile room, somewhere in the back of the Mac, with lovely custard, kind of mustard colour, really, walls, but we won't dwell on that too much. I'm really excited to have this interview because I think it's a very intriguing production that you're putting on.
Thank you.
And I think there's a kind of a nexus, if you like, if I can use that word. It's a very highbrow word. I'll try to use that. In terms of technology and security and culture, and I think that's what you're trying to tap into. And the show, the performance, is called A Machine They're Secretly Building.
Yes.
Now, what I glean from what I've seen so far, that's kind of taken from Edward Snowden. So,
absolutely, yeah. It was, we started making the show being interested in sort of looking at these hidden powers that governments have, or the full take surveillance that was kind of going on that we might perhaps weren't aware of. And we're obviously interested in the revelations that Edward Snowden provided that all appeared in The Guardian. We were looking a bit at WikiLeaks, at whistleblowers like Chelsea Manning. And yeah, that quote from Snowden just seemed really apt that they were, he says that he can't in all conscience keep quiet about this machine they're secretly building, this surveillance machine, and it just seemed to flow from there.
And there's a question, I think, Joe, you might be able to help me with this one, there's a question in the title about who they are.
Yeah, I think that's a really salient point, actually, because part of the premise for Rachel West and I to start making this piece was trying to ascertain who they are, that there's a sense amongst ourselves, our peers, our family and friends, that when they're referring to people that make the decisions, the large decisions that govern our lives, that they wouldn't do this to us. They couldn't allow this to happen to us. And when we questioned one another on who we believed they were, none of us could articulate it. And that seemed incredibly problematic and a really useful place actually for us to start investigating who they are. Yeah.
Talked a lot about us and them. And I think there's even a line in the show where it's like, you know, when did it become about us and them? It's your line, isn't it? And they are us.
Yes, they're supposed to be us, but it's quite it transpires that it's quite obvious there's two teams and who are they?
So it's tapping into, I guess, some questions around not just ownership, but I guess community in a sense, in terms of how we, you know, what are our assumptions based on? How do we define safety and security and identity is another word, isn't it, that kind of that crops up. Now in the show itself, you both play, I don't think you play characters, you kind of play platforms, don't you? You kind of... You kind of channel things or attitudes or...
We kind of borrow, we sort of think of it maybe as putting a hat on for a moment and taking it off or jumping into a world or a situation for a moment and pulling back out again. But ultimately, we're kind of ourselves
Being heightened versions of ourselves.
And we talk about, you know, where we are, could be a newsroom, could be a bunker, could be a hideout, it might just be a theatre.
Yeah.
It could be any of these things and all of those things.
And similarly, we could be secret agents, we could be double agents, we could be rebels, or we could just be really frightened like you.
There's a bit of a question, I guess, about, you know, who's on trial. Is it you two on trial? Is it the audience on trial? Is it the media on trial? Is it, you know?
Yeah, and I think that in the show, certainly, there's a purposeful ambiguity about that. Whether or not we are questioning the audience or supporting the audience, whether we're questioning ourselves and one another, or the government or whomever, there's always this sort of concern of ambiguity.
There was an audience member that saw the piece and described it as a eulogy from the end of history, which we thought was quite nice, that this kind of looking back on perhaps where we'd gone wrong or where we could go wrong, that the show was acting at points in that kind of way. And I think we found when we started making the piece, some of this stuff felt very almost conspiracy theory. People, you tell people what we were looking at and they're going, yeah, but that's not exactly true, is it? But as we've gone on, it's this show started to feel less like a prediction and maybe almost starting to be a bit of an I told you so. Things are coming true, and as we've toured it over the past year or so, it's become these things that we were dire predictions are starting to look more like actual fact.
So it's drawn, I think, from a range of sources. So you've got things that are clearly from intelligence documents, things that are film, news media, music, archive things, Pathé showreels, all those kind of different things. And what strikes me about that content is these are things now that are quite readily available, kind of through some of the things that you're attacking, or not, maybe not attacking, but kind of flagging that are potentially quite dangerous.
I think we've been, one of the points of the show is that, you know, that idea of should you change your behaviour? Should you alter how you behave in light of the fact that, you know, yes, I mean, we're promoting this show through Facebook, we're promoting this show on the radio, through Twitter, you know, we're using all of those channels. I think perhaps what some of our research has led us to is not the idea that we should change, but that we enter into these contracts with our eyes wide open, that we're informed. So I know when I give Facebook that photo or that message that I've given it to them. It's, it's theirs.
Not necessarily do I own it any longer. And I think something that's quite interesting as a side note that we've recognised that has been quite a shock to a number of our audience members is that general consensus might have us believe that when we put something on Facebook to tell Mark Zuckerberg that you don't have the right to that image or that statement. There's a general consensus that if we all believe in that, if we all, you know, then that must be the case. But it absolutely isn't. So there's so many untruths that we convince ourselves and one another of that nobody really has a sense of, in terms of legal requirements, what the case is. So yeah, it's about questioning yourself as well as to what you're prepared to believe.
So how do you approach, I'm fascinated about how you approach pulling it together. So there's lots of kind of, you know, there's lots of sources, there's lots of, I'm guessing that, you know, there's a building tension, if you like, a kind of creative tension in terms of, you know, there's something here that I want to kind of hone and pull into a kind of, you know, focus. How do you approach that? It's really difficult in terms of the variety and the diversity of the things that you're trying to explore, I think.
So as prototype, there are three of us, and so there's me and Gillian and Andrew Westerside, who's the writer and director of the piece. And so between the three of us, we were playing with material, sifting it, working out, you know, Gillian and I would be trying to get our heads around things and work out what the hell was going on and what we knew and what we didn't know and what we needed to know. And at the same time, Wes, as a writer, sat there shaping these conversations, these moments, this research. So some of the kind of the shaping and the gathering and the collating of all of this and the sifting out what's actually useful, just it took time.
Yeah.
It took kind of a year of working in different places and not working the whole year, but meeting up at different points with time in between to go away and catch
breath.
What's the important bits? So yes, some of it's just time and playing with the material and kind of keeping talking between the three of us.
I guess it's difficult with some of the kind of historical markers that you use, not to overuse them. And what I mean by that is you've got to use them to sketch context.
Yes.
But what you're trying to get to is about relationships, not always human relationships, but human technological relationships, I guess. That's no mean feat, is it, really?
The show's kind of in two halves almost, really. In the first half sort of takes us on this historical journey through those milestones, those historical moments, and kind of tries to bring us through this history of surveillance up to a kind of central point of the show where it becomes more about relationships, it becomes very human. Gillian?
Yeah, effectively, in order to make sense of where we've gotten to, we felt like we needed to offer the context historically. So we bring the audience up to speed of how we got to where we are now. And then we felt it was really important to talk incredibly truthfully about our, well, you might not recognise it as being us, but it certainly was almost verbatim, discussing how helpless one can feel. Because when you start concerning yourself with sexism, you're also concerning yourself with racism, with this law, with gun laws, with privatisation of public assets. It just goes on and on and on. And so we thought it might be useful to express to the audience that actually a lot of us feel overwhelmed by that kind of information. And I understand it happens and I'm frustrated by it, but ultimately I kind of let it happen because I don't know how to insert myself into it and make myself useful, short of going off the grid or starting a riot. We kind of thought that might be a nice place to kick off from what we concern ourselves with being the second half of the show, to say it's okay to feel completely paralysed by this because a number of us do, including me.
It's interesting you use that phrase off grid, actually, because I know a few people who sort of consciously said, I'm going to go off grid, I'm going to live or work somewhere else. It's virtually impossible to do, isn't it?
It really is.
Absolutely.
In fact, Rachel was, we were discussing that just the other day about a gentleman who had attempted to remove, in the show it is unveiled, spoiler alert, that there is a massive government data centre, which is a huge storage facility, effectively, in America, where all information all digital information is stored and kept on a scale that's completely unfathomable. Mm. And even though you may feel like you are deleting something because you get to press the button, it will never disappear. And actually, to get ownership over the information you've already given away is virtually impossible.
I wanted to ask you something about theatre and the state of theatre more generally. And there's a number of supporters, I think, who've kind of helped this tour and helped this production. Yeah. So you've got sort of art centres, universities, other kind of funders, National Lottery.
It's the Arts Council.
Arts Council. Those kind of
England, yeah.
So I'm just wondering, with something like this, which is potentially, well, it's experimental, let's call it that, it's quite provocative. Is it more difficult to fund those kind of things now because of scarcity of funding, or...?
I think generally, the arts in general is kind of being hit horribly, and there's always this case at the moment that the arts is all about the money, and that the money is the primary thing, and it's growth, and it's this and that. And actually, you know, the arts are vital, the arts are important. They give us a platform to talk about these terrible, terrifying things. We felt overwhelmed by certainly all this information and what we were researching, what we were discovering. Mm-hmm. And as artists, as theatre makers, we're lucky enough to have a platform, have a space where we've got some people in a room for an hour and we can start a conversation. Mm-hmm. Even if you tell people the bare facts, the cold, hard truth of what's going on, it's kind of dull, it's kind of boring, and it falls out of your mind and you just kind of don't care. And you just, you know, Facebook's easy, it's fun to use, I'll just put it on there. But as humans, we gravitate towards stories and towards narratives and towards kind of something more theatrical, something more artistic. By telling a story, we help to unlock these things and you can actually affect a change. Mm. So I think, yeah, it's hard to get it's hard to get anything funded and supported. Mm. You know, I mean, Mac here has suffered a really horrific cut at the moment. And they're battling against that and want people, you know, people love this venue and Mac are really encouraging them to, if you love us, use us, help this venue to keep going. But it's the same all across the landscape, and it's kind of really sad because now, when the world is in quite such a parlous state, it's more important than ever that we've got ways of expressing ourselves, of coming together.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think actually what is additionally disappointing, it's not just about a particular form of disseminating information that's being quashed by cutting funding. It's a building for communities to form. It's a space for people to engage with one another socially, with their children, with their neighbours whom they might not otherwise meet. And not to take it too far away from the subject, but it's not just the arts, it's libraries, it's education, all of the platforms by which we might learn and exchange are being seen as less important because financially it's very difficult, we are informed, to equate that to growth because it's slow.
And there's a tension there, isn't there, between the kind of community focus and that kind of culture of individualism that has been in part thrust forward by technology,
isn't it?
In terms of, you know, how we live our lives.
I mean, we need the arts now more than ever to bring us together for shared experience, for learning, for understanding, so that as people we grow rather than as an economy growing.
Just to finish, I'm going to ask you a very important wardrobe question. Okay.
No.
Not about wardrobes, but about costumes. Okay. Now there's a very prominent magenta balaclava.
There is
in the performance.
The pink balas.
And the balaclava, you know, has had a checkered history, shall we say. But do you think the balaclava is now something that is kind of, do you think it's a kind of weapon of anonymity, or do you think it's now something that symbolises something that makes people more visible?
It's a very difficult question, and as children of the 80s, we had this discussion when we made this piece. We were both born in 1980, and had very particular memories of black balaclavas being used for acts of terrorism in the UK. And we started working with black balaclavas and found it incredibly difficult to see it as something other than
what we'd seen on the news as kids.
Basically something that was in relation to acts of violence, and that wasn't our intention. Initially it was about anonymity.
and protest, perhaps, exactly. and the right to privacy. And we wanted the right for the balaclava to be able to reference an act of terrorism, but then also reference an act of protest or an act of anonymity. So with it being pink, it just kind of, and obviously it references Pussy Riot as well, and yes. those kind of protest and that kind of activism, the colour, and you know, the pink's just great, it moves us away from that black balaclava and it only being one thing and allows it to be many things.
It's a very underworn garment, I think, now, isn't it?
Do you think?
I think so. A bit like the black or brown shirt, I think. You know,
oh my.
History has kind of cast it somewhere.
We did recognise the potential for it to be an incredibly threatening garment. And I think that's why we went very pink, because it needed to seem non-threatening but purposeful. And I think Pussy Riot got that very, very right.
It is very pink, and a good place to finish.
More now from New Art West Midlands 2017, which you can find at the Waterhall Gallery, Mac Birmingham and the Wolverhampton Art Gallery until the 14th of May, and at Worcester City Art Gallery until the 3rd of June. As our curiosities abound, we need, I feel, to consult another one of the showcase's curators.
I'm with Lisa, who's another person in that kind of curator bracket. You've got a big long title. Do you want to just tell us what that big long title is?
Yeah, so I'm curator of modern and contemporary art. So I work with contemporary artists and I'm responsible for the modern fine art collection from 1900 onwards.
Now that is an amazing job, isn't it?
It's pretty good, yeah.
I imagine it's pretty good.
It's interesting, yeah.
And let's talk about your involvement in tonight's exhibition. How do you come to the table, as it were?
So we're the lead partners, so I'm involved really from the outset. So I kind of sit in on the selection panel when that happens in the summer. So, and then I curate the show at the Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery. So I work with a number of the artists to put on a really great show.
And that's quite tricky, I guess, is it? Sitting there kind of assessing, sort of selecting. What's going through your mind when you've got all these great pieces of creative work in front of you?
I mean, it's difficult because I think the calibre of the artist is really high. It's really great quality. And yeah, it's really difficult kind of getting it down. You know, we get a lot of applications. So, you know, the artists that make it through are really, really good artists.
And are there limits to what can be in and what can, you know, what's sort of ruled out? Are there things you think, oh, I'm not sure about that? Or, you know, is it, how do you assess them? What's the kind of criteria?
So the criteria really is they're assessed on artistic merit, really. So we're looking for really high quality work, ambitious ideas. I mean, these artists have graduated from six of the West Midlands art schools in the last 3 years. So they could have just finished or they could be out practicing for a couple of years. So we're just looking for artwork that we feel is really ambitious, is exciting. You know, they've communicated it in a really high quality format. Maybe they're using a particular medium in a new way. So we're just looking for artwork that really interests us and really grips us.
And there are, and in the hall that we're standing in, there are some amazing examples of that. When I walked in here earlier, I thought, oh, there'll be some paintings and some sculptures and things, but there's some very intriguing things. I mean, in terms of the standard and the kind of the diversity of the work, how's that changed over the last sort of 4 or 5 years that the exhibition's been running?
I mean, this is the fifth year of the exhibition, and I think every year, you know, we get a variety of mediums every year, and that really reflects what's happening in the contemporary art world kind of, you know, broadly, and the artists are working a whole range of mediums. You know, some are still, you know, working with kind of traditional mediums like painting and drawing, you know, photography, and then others are, you know, working in performance, they're working in kind of mixed media installation, they could, you know, big films, animation, and we try and show all of that, so nothing phases us, and you know, we're here to make sure that we're presenting the artist's work to the best, in the best possible way.
And what do you think it says just more broadly about kind of culture locally in the West Midlands? People are always a bit sniffy about the West Midlands in terms of its kind of its culture, I think. Certainly, maybe it's just the people I talk to, I don't know.
Yeah.
What do you think, you know, it's a very vibrant scene, isn't there?
There is. I think there's definitely no reason to be sniffy at all. And I think, you know, art's not elitist. You know, art's about talking, it's about conversation, it's about ideas. And I think that's why artists are so important, is that they're reflecting what's happening in society and they're, you know, making it visible and making us really think about things. And I just think, you know, whether you like contemporary art or not, I think you should come along and kind of have a look and see what you think and join in the conversation, really. And I think in terms of the talent in the West Midlands, I mean, you know, there's great amounts of talent in the West Midlands. There's lots of arts organisations, you know, lots of emerging talent, lots of established artists that have come out of the region, internationally renowned artists that have, you know, born and bred in the West Midlands. So, yeah, there's absolutely nothing to be sniffy about. I think you really need to get involved.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to go and find out, I think, now what the gas mask is about. I'm intrigued by the gas mask.
Folks
that come in here will know what I mean.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, thanks very much. Thanks for your time.
No worries. Thank you.
Now, in my experience, the art world is full of colourful characters and rising stars. None more so, perhaps, than Poppy Twist.
So I'm with the fabulously named Poppy Twist. How good is that as a name for an artist?
It's the best name.
I think it's probably the best name.
People always ask me, like, is that your real name? And I'll get out my passport and be like, here you go. Wow. And you know what? Facebook thought that my name was fake and actually blocked my account until I could prove it was real.
That's outrageous. Absolutely outrageous.
So there you go. That's
what
happens.
I bet your passport's a work of art in itself.
Indeed.
Now, rather excitingly, earlier on this evening, you won a prize.
Yes.
And not just any prize, but I think you won a bit of money, didn't you?
I won a bit of money, yeah.
Which will help you in your artistic endeavour.
It will, very much so.
Excellent. So let's talk about that endeavour. You do sort of video, audio, or...?
Video, audio installation, and a little bit of textiles work as well. So I'm very interested in performance. I've been in bands since I was a teenager and kind of done the whole, like, touring, getting signed to record labels kind of thing, and experienced all of those anxieties and just, like, ups and downs that come along with that. And I'm kind of, in my work, I'm kind of reliving some of those anxieties and those awkward feelings.
Is that still a thing for you? Are you still doing music?
Yes, I am. In fact, I was in London last night playing, so I'm probably quite hungover and tired. And yet here I am, so yeah, it's
a workaholic.
Quite fun. Yeah, definitely.
So how does that help in terms of, you know, approaching some of your video art, video installation? Does it help, or is it a sort of distraction?
It does help, and I mean, I've always been interested in just pop culture more generally and memorabilia and fan art and all of those kind of things. So all of those inform my work as well. Just the sort of experience of getting photographs of yourself taken in order to sell yourself to an audience, all of those kind of ideas are interesting.
Now I should say, as we're talking, you are wearing a rather fabulous, I think
Elvis
it's probably
scarf.
Silk scarf of,
yes.
of Elvis Presley himself.
Yes.
Now, I'm a big fan of Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Elvis is a lot of things, and I think in some way he's a bit of a warning, isn't he? He's a bit of a warning about what happens if you get too successful, or
potentially,
what happens
yeah,
if you get too caught up in pop culture.
Indeed, yeah. And I'm wearing one of the scarves that kind of inspired my work tonight. I didn't want to wear one that I'd made because I thought that might be a little bit too... I could have, I suppose,
yeah,
but
well.
I really like this one, and I think it's got two sides.
It's fantastic.
It's two different Elvises.
I believe that phase is the mature Elvis.
I feel like that might be a little bit, potentially a little bit younger, the side that I've got on, and then that's more of the kind of the white and gold suit disco Elvis that we came to know
before he passed.
Indeed.
Yes. So is there something in your work about icons and about iconography?
Yes.
So explain that. Tell me about that a little. In rock and roll, I guess Elvis is the man, isn't he? Really?
Yeah, and I guess it's kind of that tension between the way that we kind of big those kind of people up and the fact that they are still essentially fallible. They're humans just like us. And they die on the toilet and, you know, and all of those kind of things. You know, they're no more godlike than any of us. So I feel like that's quite an interesting thing to explore, those kind of, the fact that all people are vulnerable, no matter how much you kind of make them seem like they're untouchable.
Now, most artists, or certainly the ones I meet, they kind of go through different phases of things, and then they find something that they think, oh, that's me, that's my niche, if you like, that's the thing I love.
Yes.
So where did you start? Did you start with a pencil and a paper? Or
yes.
Is that where you start, traditional art, if you like?
Yeah, I guess coming from sort of A-level, that would be sort of the thing that you would just do because it was the easiest thing to do in a school, and it was the thing that you were kind of, that was just a prescriptive kind of thing. It made sense for everyone to do. And I kind of became more interested in video, really through doing music videos for myself, like my bands, and then for other bands. And that's kind of where I learn video editing and all of those kind of things.
And, so, and can you remember a piece or an artist that kind of set you on fire in terms of, I want to do that?
Yeah, I really like Ian and Jane's work. They did the Nick Cave documentaries that were like the feature-length documentaries, but they've also done loads of really interesting work just about the sort of the fan experience and also performance in general. And I did my dissertation on them, so
wow.
So that would be my biggest inspiration, I think.
Several thousand words, I imagine,
Ten thousand.
Words.
I actually got to interview them for my documentary, interview them for my dissertation as well. So
wow.
So that was really good in terms of like getting like a real understanding of why they do things the way they do them and all of that.
Obviously, there's a lot of work that goes into getting ready for an exhibition, mm-hmm. like pieces in for an exhibition, mm-hmm. and then you get to a point and think, all right, okay, I've done that. What do I do next? So, what are you doing next? You've got your band and you've got other things going on.
Yeah, I've got my band. I do video work commercially as well. So I'm very involved in sort of creative things in Birmingham in general. So I've done some video for Millennium Point, for example. But also just like music videos for artists in the area and beyond. So I've just done a video for Goddamn, who are a reasonably well-known sort of, well, black country band.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, just like fingers in as many pies as I can, really. But I, obviously, you know, I've got this this little grant, so I'll be thinking of ways that I can use that to expand my technological sort of
I would say, if
exploration.
You're in a band and you win money, I think a new guitar is probably on your way, isn't it?
New drums, in my case.
Oh, drum. That's your weapon of choice.
That's mine, yeah. Nice. Yeah, but I don't feel like that would be a particularly... Oh, I mean, I suppose there are drums in my installation, so, you know, it wouldn't be a ludicrous expense.
Sounds like you've got a perfect excuse already.
It does, yeah, definitely.
Well, Poppy, it's been great to talk to you.
And you.
And thanks for your time. Thank you very much.
No problem.
Thank you.
To wind things up, I got some perspective and wisdom from the man in charge, Craig Ashley.
Okay, so I'm with Craig Ashley from New Art West Midlands. And Craig, you're kind of behind a lot of what's going on tonight, aren't you?
Indeed, yeah. I'm the director of New Art West Midlands. So I kind of oversee this exhibition, which is taking place over four sites across the West Midlands. And our key aim really is about supporting artists at the outset of their career, but also beyond that, making sure that they are enabled to practice and stay in the West Midlands too. That's important.
Indeed. So how's that collaboration come about then? That's sort of been growing over the last few years.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the fifth year of New Art West Midlands. So it's emerged through, well, initially a piece of research for Arts Council England that was trying to look at how to support artists and grow the arts ecology in the region. So we started talking to artists, arts organisations, but also our universities, our art schools, about what was needed, how we support people to get to that next step in their career. So the exhibition emerged from that as a very visible part of what we do.
Do you think people underestimate the kind of power of culture sometimes?
I think they do and they don't. It's there in everything we do. I think sometimes you might not kind of categorize it or pigeonhole it as culture when you visit the cinema or you watch a film on TV or even you walk past a piece of public artwork in the public realm. I think the galleries can be a tricky area because they automatically frame it with a set of conventions that people think they should conform to about being quiet in the gallery space or that it's intellectually highbrow. So I think how we feel about culture can be anything that's human related, to be honest, but crucially it's a creative endeavor, and that's what makes us humans, really.
And something like this, an exhibition like this, I think is really helpful in the sense that it's very accessible. You know, it's kind of here at the Mac in the middle of Cannon Hill Park, but it's not just about, you know, how accessible it is to get in. You know, people can sort of drift in and out as they like, but in terms of the pieces and the selection, it's very challenging, but it's not kind of too challenging, it puts people off.
Yeah, and that's great credit to the institutions, so to MAC, to Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery, to Wolverhampton Art Gallery and Worcester City Art Gallery. They've got the expertise in that area. They understand how to engage with audiences. And I think artists too, with the development of artistic practice, they've got a direct line of communication to audiences through social media, through websites, online practice. So it's a more direct conversation with the audience that artists are aware of. So it's a combination of those things, I think. But yeah, I think all artwork, if you present it and frame it in the right way, and you give people the skills they need, or the language they need to decipher, if there is any deciphering to do, it gets rid of those barriers.
And earlier on, you very ably did some prize giving, made a bit of an announcement, and then you did some prize giving. And how chuffed did the artists look when they won their prize?
Ah, incredibly chuffed, and I'm so delighted about that. I mean, it's not naturally a competitive environment, the visual arts, and the prizes are no way intended to be that. But they're to enable artists to continue and practice doing what they do. So the fact that we've managed to pair up six artists with organisations, we've managed to award three prizes of £1,000, two prizes from our sponsor Cass Art of £250. I think these are all tools that help us to provide for artists and give them that helping hand. But it also gives confidence, and I think that's what an artist wants to walk away from an exhibition like this with, is increased confidence and ready to move to that next opportunity. So we're always thinking about what comes next for an artist. Exhibitions are never the end point. They're always that stepping stone to the next thing.
And what's nice, I think, one thing I've picked up about this evening, what's nice is there are a number of people who have kind of been involved in some way before, or have been, you know, had an art project linked to the work that you do, and then sort of come back, and you know, you yourself have a link to the MAC and that kind of stuff. There's a kind of family growing, isn't there, over time?
Yes, and as a network, we're the contemporary visual arts network for the region, and that, I think we can underestimate sometimes how long those things take to develop. And they're about relationships at the end of the day, and they're about support, mutual support. And that's key to New Art West Midlands, and you can see it's great you've spotted it tonight. Yeah, I think that's what keeps me really engaged, is as much as you might know someone and be able to connect them into the network, new people are kind of joining and want to be a part of it. And it can be a lonely life being an artist. You often think about the sole artist in the attic studio working alone. So it's about an environment that enables conversation around an artistic practice, that just that conversation, just that social side of things, helps to move it along, and it leads to opportunities.
I think it's a fantastic exhibition. I think it's on to the end of May.
It's on to the 14th of May, or
well, middle of May,
3rd of June at Worcester.
Ah, okay. So yeah. People get even more.
Indeed.
Even more for their hard-earned free entry.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
Yes.
Greg,
yeah.
Thanks very much for talking to me.
That's great. Thank
Cheers.
You.
Thanks.
And now it's time to close the box. We'll be back for more on Wednesday, the 10th of May. And for details of the shows and for the podcast versions, go to thenewcuriositiesbox.blogspot.co.uk. Our thanks to New Art West Midlands, MAC Birmingham and Prototype Theatre. The New Curiosities Box is a King of the Buttons production for Switch Radio. Now, where's my paint?